Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to The Whistleblowers. After another Hollywood weekend of Premier League action, we are back to dissect everything we can be bothered to dissect. Liverpool failed to capitalise on the best result in their entire history. Arsenal continued being brilliant. Man City kept up the pressure on them, while Man United dropped points at home to bottom place Southampton. We're going to talk about all of that plus much more. Alongside me is Gareth Dobson, King of Tottenham. Good result for your boys this weekend, Gareth.
It was. It was, you know, you have one win, you forget about the three defeats before it, and it's kind of enjoyable watching this sort of collection of pantomime horses stumbling towards the top four finish line.
Yeah, what do you give your chances at the moment? If I was to gun to your head, I mean, this is, I don't have to do this, but I am doing it. Gun to your head, it's loaded, you've heard it click. What are you saying?
You spun the barrel. I'm going to say 65%.
Oh, you're quite confident.
Yeah, fairly confident. I think that I think that Newcastle are too limited. I mean, they had to fight incredibly hard for a win against the, I know Wolves are a doughty team, as they like to say, but, you know, they've really huffed and puffed. And, you know, I'm not sure Liverpool are going to have many feet left, given how many times they shoot themselves in them.
Yeah, well, we're not going to talk about Spurs anymore later on in the programme. So this is your opportunity now to get anything off your chest that you really want to talk about Spurs related.
I think this may relate more to the tactical deficiencies of Nottingham Forest and anything specific to Spurs. You know, Spurs did their job, they did it well. It was nice to see Son get back involved. But I think, you know, Nottingham Forest played so openly, especially in the second half when they were chasing, that it was the single worst thing you can do against Spurs. The only thing Spurs are basically fairly competent at is counterattacks.
Yeah. I mean, for some reason, I feel like that front three has sort of gone to pieces very quickly. Son doesn't seem to be anywhere near the player he was last season. Kulusevski doesn't seem to be getting the same... He's not getting that same penetration he was getting in the back end of last season. I think he was a January signing, wasn't he, last season? And he was just unbelievable straight away. This time round, it seems to be a strange one.
Yeah, no, he came with Bentancur and he was brilliant. He was probably the difference that put us in the top four last year. And he came back, he's had some injuries, missed a lot of the first part of the season, the pre-World Cup bit. And obviously, you know, Richarlison has had problems with injury. I mean, he's been a disruptive element, not him himself. I know he had a little bit of a paddy on midweek, but, you know, understandably so. And Conte obviously used that well. He turned it around and said, well, you start on Saturday and you show me why you should be playing. He played brilliantly, but Richarlison's ideal position is coming off the left, but they have stuck with Son through thick and thin to the point where I think even Son with a bit, he's probably, you know, shouldn't be starting every game by default. So yeah. I think Son has been so good for Spurs, and he's been overshadowed, understandably, by Spurs' all-time greatest striker now, that I think, you know, it's easy to overlook even what he achieved. Like, you know, a 20 goal a season striker who's the second striker for your team is, you know, it's phenomenal. So I think him dropping off so substantially has had a huge effect on the team.
Yeah, I think so. Look, Gareth, I feel like I had to start with Spurs there because you're co-hosting the show with me, but you've had that bit of grace to talk about your little victory, your 3 points. Congratulations to all of you.
You good little win.
Now, this is it. Now I'm going to juxtapose that with something much worse for you mentally, I think. Arsenal. Let's go in with Arsenal, because they looked just... They made Fulham look like a team that's just come up. And I know Fulham are that, but they haven't looked like that all season. They've looked brilliant. They were swatted away at Craven Cottage by Arsenal. I thought Arsenal were brilliant. They made absolutely no fuss over it whatsoever. Let's hear from Boyd Hilton. Boyd Hilton's the host of the Footballist at the Arsenal podcast.
Hi, this is Boyd, reporting on the victory for Arsenal at Fulham today. I think this was just an absolute joy to behold for an Arsenal fan. completely dominated the first half. Had a goal disallowed for offside, which was very close, and then just kind of carried on as we need to go on, really. And I think the attacking players, Trossard in particular, is just a revelation, just kind of slipped into the whole way we play with remarkable ease since we bought him for hardly any money whatsoever. Saka, Martinelli is brilliant as ever. I mean, the midfield was fantastic. You know, it was really just incredibly heartwarming to see. And obviously Fulham were pretty terrible in that first half as well. But all in all, each time we play at the moment, I kind of feel more and more for Arsenal fans that you think you're finally being convinced with 11 games to go that we're in this title race and that we could win it. If we manage to keep this level of performance up, and we've got that thing that Man City have where teams feel like they're a bit scared of us, and quite a lot scared of us, really. And I feel like we make other teams nervous, and that's what happened with Fulham today. So yeah, absolute triumph, and I'm very excited to see what happens next week against Crystal Palace.
Yeah, they do have that sort of relentlessness that teams seem to have these days in the Premier League. You seem to have to be getting minimum 90 points to win a league now. And that's partly because of Man City and what they've done over the last 5 or 6 years. But they've definitely got it. I didn't think we'd be talking about this still now. I didn't think we'd be talking about an Arsenal, not just challenge, but an Arsenal campaign in which they're leading from the front.
Yeah, I think we talked about this last week. You know, I've moved from they might win to they could win, to they should win to they will win. It's, and I suspect that last week's victory against Bournemouth will be. Do you remember was it the 1992-93 season where United were pushing for their first Premier League title, their first top division title, and Steve Bruce scored those two headers against Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah,
and there was dancing on the pitch, and the winner was late, and it feels like this is going to be the footage that's mirrored in Arsenal terms. The winner against Bournemouth. I think that's going to be the marker. That was when they showed the mental fortitude and all those things that people like to talk about, which have nothing to do with what necessarily happened on the pitch in terms of gameplay. It's more about the will to win. Everything else. It's the as the Americans like to say, it's the intangibles.
Yeah, it's that thing of having a player or two in that side that you can look over to. As another player, you can look over and be like, well, we're not going to lose the game because he's on the pitch with us. And I think Arsenal have got two or three of those now. And there's a real togetherness there. I'm really impressed with them. But let's talk for a second about Trossard, because I think he got three assists, wasn't it, at the weekend. He's been really good. As soon as he's come into Arsenal, he's been excellent. Looked like he'd been there for years. Now, I'm not going to go down this route because I'm not that guy. But there was a lot of talk.
Take my hands. Lead me down this path.
Arsenal, there's a lot of talk about them missing out on Mudryk. Mudryk taking the Chelsea offer instead. Or more likely, Chelsea offering more money than Arsenal could. But they didn't get Mudryk, and Arsenal fans seem to be gutted about that because it felt like that could have been a real shot in the arm halfway through the season, getting this really top-quality player. But Trossard, in terms of this season and maybe next season, he's the smart pick anyway, right? He must be. We don't know anything about Mudryk. Yes, he's looked brilliant in certain games. Yes, it could be unbelievable. But he is showing that he's taking a little bit of time to settle in. And ultimately, Arsenal want to win something. And if they don't win it this season, it might not happen again for a while. So surely Arsenal fans now must be over the moon with Trossard, right?
Oh, of course. And there'll be a lot of hastily deleted tweets from January 31st when signing, from Arsenal fans who were, I know it's easy to pick on Arsenal fans because they are, very emotionally reactive, but they were so outraged that their, transfer window business, bringing in Jorginho and Trossard, when we need to improve the team, these players don't improve the team. And which is funny because the whole point of the Arteta era, this evolution, is that he's weeded out these players who essentially don't do what is required. And he's molded a younger team in his own image. And, the players he's brought in are players that augment his squad rather than make wholesale changes. It's like, and if it isn't broken, why would you attempt to fix it? So I think I always thought Trossard was a smart signing. Like, not actually the player to put them over the top, but certainly one I didn't think was going to slow him down. I mean, he's had, you know, excellent periods at Brighton. He's blown a little bit hot and cold, but, you know, I think, didn't he go up to Anfield and absolutely run riot about a year ago? I think yeah. that, and he's also, I think he fits a certain type you might need, you know, when the, you know, when you're really in the thick of it. You know, he's nippy, as they like say, and I don't mean that in a fast way. You know, he's a little shit.
Exactly what you want.
Yeah, and it doesn't surprise me that Conte wanted him, because he's the sort of player that Conte loves. It's why he loves players like Richarlison as well. Absolutely, you know, hell bent on winning at all costs.
Yeah, he also seems like a player who he's had to put this nicely. So Brighton are a good club, of course they are. They're not as big a club as Arsenal, we know that. Trossard may feel like this is his last chance of getting a big move to a big club. And I think he seems like the sort of player who understands that his role might not be playing 38 games a season. I don't think he's a squad player or a rotation player, but I think he is definitely more like that than Martinelli, Saka, you know, whoever. So he's a player who could be there for 3 or 4 seasons playing, you know, 22, 23 games a season, and quite happy with that lot if he's winning things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, again, you know, you need, what, 22 players to... real contributing players to win league, and I think they probably were a couple short of that, especially midfield. You know, bringing Jorginho seems to make a lot of sense, and you know, having that extra attacking on. Then when Trossard came, Martinelli was in a real dip. He's only found his form in the last couple of weeks. And so these are all, you know, horrifyingly for me, you know, these are all really smart, sensible signings that, you know, if they didn't pay out, it wasn't the reason why they weren't going to win the title. But if they do pay out, you can turn around and say, well, the guys, the team, the board, the manager, you know, they made brilliant calls. So I think that, you know, and credit to, you know, especially Trossard coming in instantly. And like you said, you know, Mudryk was a player who you're probably looking at next season for to really make his impact. So for a player to come in, you know, an experienced Premier League player and do well, it's exactly what they needed.
Definitely. Right, before the break, let's talk about Man City. I don't know if you saw their game against Palace on Saturday evening.
Yes.
But now we know that City probably, man for man, may still be the best team in the league. They're probably the best team in the world, to be honest. But they're going to need to go on one of these runs now. They're going to need, and we know they can do it, but they're going to need to go on one where they just don't drop a point for the next 10 games. And the game against Palace felt like the first litmus test of that run, where they didn't play particularly well. Palace were pretty dogged, although unbelievably poor going forward. But dogged, and they were well organised, and at home with that crowd, they always have a, you know, they always have an extra man, essentially. And that was a test that Man City passed only just, but that's all you need to do. Pass it just with a penalty from Haaland. Talk me through it, Gareth.
Well, I mean, I live about 5 minutes walk from Selhurst Park, and you can hear the roar, or most of these days the murmur from my back garden. And you know, it was a game that, you know, Selhurst Park under lights is a thing. There is a real atmosphere. Okay. There's almost, I'm not sure if they are corrugated tin roofs, but it feels like it. And the sound really reverberates around it. And City have not had a particularly good record against Crystal Palace. I mean, Andros's Townsend, absolute belter, you know, not so long ago, still sticks in the memory. So you could probably argue that, you know, to beat Palace, which was probably a fixture, I think, you know, Pep, as we know, gets in his own head. If things don't go well against certain teams, he seems to be very obsessive about it. So I think, you know, while for your average, you know, Premier League fixture, it looks unremarkable, it might well stand out as one where, you know, they did well to go and get that win. And it is, you know, I was reading an article yesterday, sort of wondering why Invo Haaland is, you know, maybe already the best striker in the world, why he hasn't improved Manchester City. And he was still incredibly, you know, he didn't particularly feel involved in that game, but he's still there when it counts. You know, to step up and take a penalty in the 80th minute is still worth something. And it's the threat. I think it's the threat and the presence of Haaland which counts for a lot. He takes players out of the game by virtue of who he is.
He scares the shit out of players still. He can see it. You can, even when he's not on it at all, when he's not involved in the game at all, he is occupying 3 players every single time he's anywhere near the ball. It's It's really interesting to watch. All right, we're going to take a quick break, after which we'll talk about Man United Southampton, and we'll talk about West Ham. Welcome back to the Whistleblowers. Let's talk about United Southampton. Gareth, I don't know if you saw this or saw the highlights or what. One of the most entertaining nil-nils I've seen for a long, long time. Talk to me about Casemiro. There's a stat that he hadn't been sent off in 400 games or whatever it is, both in Portuguese football and at Real Madrid. And now he's had two red cards in 3 months in England. First of all, it's a red card, that, right?
Yeah, I think it has to be. You know, he goes, the moment that you ostensibly miss the ball and you go over the ball and you take someone's, you know, just above the ankle, it's
I don't think he meant, I don't think it was malicious.
But it's a red card. And I think his reaction was, yeah, he was very apologetic. He was very upset because I think he both realised that, A, it was a really nasty tackle, foul, and also because it was so unintentional, he was like, oh my god, what have I done, in both the, you know, the potential injury sense, but also in the I was not looking to clean that guy out.
Yeah, but ultimately, I mean, the only reason that his foot bounces off the top of the ball is that his foot was high enough in relation to the ball for it to bounce off it. So it was a poor challenge. But yeah, I actually don't think he is that sort of player. I think he's a very he's a player that fouls technically a lot, breaks games up a lot, and is a bit of a nightmare. But I don't think he's a nasty player.
He's not Vinny Jones. Reaction. I mean, no. I think that, I mean, one. So he's, you know, was he 30? He's never been a quick player. His, you know, rather like all the best defensive footballers, it's all about the anticipation, reading the game, stopping things before the situation occurs. And that probably just shows, you know, the Premier League is such a quick game that you only have to be like one jot off the pace in any given moment. And what might be a really good tackle in any other league, and you're off. And that's not to imply that he has any deficiencies as a footballer. You know, he's been probably their player of the season. He's absolutely brilliant, but I think it's more about a player who's only been there for 6 months. Well, he's essentially, yeah. Well, especially when he's being partnered by either McTominay or Fred. I mean, you know, I think another football writer with Bruno on Sunday, and obviously that, I think that was partly about the fact that they played on the Thursday night in the Europa League, and, you know, trying to, again, talking about having a big enough squad. You know, Man United's first 11 is fantastic, and but you get to play a 16, 17, and it shows the difference between them and Man City and Chelsea. And I think, yeah, I agree. He does too much because he's turned around the team. His presence there, probably more than any other, and perhaps the absence of Ronaldo has been a huge thing. But that's, you know, you can't be perfect in every game.
No. Also worth mentioning Southampton here, because they'll feel they could have won that game, probably should have done, missed some good chances. I thought they were playing well, even 11 versus 11. So they definitely got a shot at staying up. A team that is finding themselves getting sucked into this. I mean, it's not even being sucked in anymore. They are right in it. It's this West Ham. I think we both look at that squad that West Ham have got and think, well, they're definitely really good. They're too good to even be anywhere near this. They should be, you know, mid-table minimum. And yet at the moment, it's just awful. And first of all, let's hear from Tom Rennie. Tom is a football broadcaster and West Ham fan. Here's Tom with his take on West Ham at the moment.
The good news about recording these West Ham reviews for you is that I don't need to update the script very much. It was the same mediocre performance we've seen from West Ham for well over a year. Certainly this season has been a disaster, but all this, they've turned things around. It's 2 wins in 14. It's 6 wins all season. It's out of the relegation zone after today's draw against Aston Villa. And no game next week means they could be bottom of the league before they play in the Premier League again. The performance against Aston Villa was okay, but they conceded a soft goal. The defensive work of Tilo Kehrer remains the stuff of nightmares. The midfield, Paqueta, Sojek and Rice, does not work. Bowen and Benrahma actually had quite good games, but they couldn't convert from open play, nor could they set up Danny Ings for a decent chance. And there was no kind of desire to win at the end. Aston Villa, nothing to play for, and were perfectly competent and comfortable, if unspectacular. West Ham needed to win against Aston Villa. And when 6 minutes were added on at the end of the game, people started to go. It wouldn't be like that at Old Trafford, Elland Road, even the Vitality Stadium, because you think, right, we're going to have a go at this. West Ham just never were going to. They have not scored a goal in the opening 15 minutes of any game this season. They never looked like scoring from open play. The penalty they got was dubious at best. And they do it every single week. David Moyes doesn't make changes. David Moyes can't improve things in game. And the old way of scoring a goal from a corner, 12 corners against Aston Villa. They did win a penalty from one, but didn't score from the other 11. Can they go down? Yeah. Will they go down? I think they will, actually. Because the other teams are showing a heck of a lot more fight than West Ham are. And West Ham are just morose. Every week, the same malaise. Every week, the same problems. It's not getting put right. And they've thrown away almost all the winnable home games now. Still to come at home, Arsenal, Liverpool, Manchester United, a hugely important penultimate home game of the season against Leeds, and Southampton at the start of the next run of games post-international break. I just don't see them getting the 5 or 6 wins required. As I mentioned, they don't win away and they can't win at home. It's pitiful. It's pathetic. But mainly, it's just left everyone feeling flat because nothing is happening. So I don't think West Ham will stay up if they keep David Moyes. If they do, he simply has to go. The players seem fed up of him, the fans seem fed up of him, and he seems fed up of him. And I know I am.
That was broadcaster Tom Rennie, West Ham fan, disgruntled West Ham fan. He's right to be annoyed, though, isn't he, Gareth?
Yeah, disappointed or maybe even perplexed, given how good they were last year. This happened with Everton a lot, didn't it? They almost felt like 1 year on, 1 year off under Moyes. And
yeah.
I think someone I heard suggested that he's very good when he's the underdog. And then when there's a weight of expectation, it doesn't seem to work out. I mean, it seemed quite telling that, I mean, he's really struggled to implement these players they brought in the last year. And, Souček was dropped and now Souček's been put back in and there is almost that old kind of, well, you're the guys who got me out of the first mess. So let's go back to this. And it does seem like he's kind of short on ideas and he doesn't quite know how to change things. I mean, possibly because he's always been a manager with a very specific kind of style and way about the way they play and so forth. And when it's good. And, you know, It's great being an underdog when you're being plucky and pulling things out, but the moment that you're expected to win a few games and you fall flat on your face, it must be hugely frustrating.
Yeah, I think especially with players like Paquetá, who is obviously a top quality player. He's Brazil's number 10 at the moment. I mean, he plays every game for Brazil and clearly has an enormous amount of ability, but it just seems like it's not the right fit. And that's fair to say, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I'd be really surprised if Moyes was the one leading the charge for a Brazilian number 10 from Ligue 1. It does strike. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's really unfair.
Yeah, let's slag our Moyes off. Don't stop slagging Moyes off. Well, listen, the thing with West Ham is, and Tom Rennie, who you heard from there, he's talked about it at length and he's mentioned it on Twitter a lot. Moyes, for a lot of West Ham fans, is not the right guy to see out the remainder of the season for West Ham. There's a good chance that this new manager bounce we talk about, if you don't get a new manager, you don't get the bounce. And West Ham are at the moment just sort of sleepwalking towards relegation without even really trying to do anything about it. They've kept with Moyes. It's not too late to change it. I'm not advocating they sack him. I don't want that to happen, obviously. But I wouldn't be surprised if it happened tomorrow, for example. And you'd have to say, well, at least they're being proactive about it. What's your take on this new manager bounce situation?
The new manager bounce, it's real. I mean, there's statistics that show that for 2 or 3 games, you know, teams have an elevated performance in results, certainly. And there's a lot of reasons behind it. It might be, you know, if a new manager comes in and implements a new style, all that old tape is out the window. Maybe teams find it hard to game plan a little bit. You know, they can't watch the last 20 games. Maybe it does lift the dressing room. Maybe certain players you know, come in and feel they've got something to prove or something to show. So it does work. And for me, the big thing's always been about the timing of these changes. You know, you look at the clubs currently in the bottom three, and admittedly, you know, you essentially have a bottom eight from 12 to 20. You know, Palace in 12th are separated by 3 points from Bournemouth, third bottom. And, you know, Southampton, Leeds changed their manager fairly recently. They're the bottom two. Bournemouth did it a lot earlier. They, you know, they won two of the last four, so showing signs. And then you look at teams who stuck with the manager. You know, Leicester have now lost their last four and are, you know, level on points with the bottom three. You have Nottingham Forest, who looked like they were going to be absolutely fine, and now, you know, you're talking about teams walking towards relegation zone. Them and Crystal Palace could be put in the same boat. There's an 8-point gap between 11th, which is Villa, and 12th. And it's like, it's so pronounced now that there's only so many teams who have a chance left to roll a dice. And I do wonder whether you almost have to kind of time it. You change your manager now, you get a couple of wins and you might well be absolutely fine. If you've gone too early, you know, what can you do? Like, you know, Leeds, for example, are out of options. They couldn't do anything. Southampton's different because they were absolutely rooted at the bottom, and they've now, you know, they've lost only one of the last four. There's been promising signs. They had some good cup performances. So it's, I think there's an art to it. There's a science to it. I don't know whether clubs realize that or really look at it, or maybe I'm being overly cynical about it, but
yeah, you've got to hope they do
and time it.
But they've worked out the exact minute to which you're supposed to eat pasta on a match day. They surely have worked out the exact week with which you're supposed to have sat your manager by. I mean, at least Southampton pulled the trigger early.
Yeah, can you imagine if the club staff sat there and managed to inform the board of the exact point when they themselves should be sacked?
Yeah.
So our data person says if you sack them, he or her, you know, round about game week 27, that should.
Yeah, and I brought my own data analyst with me, and that's the one who's telling me I've got to go now. Sadly, that's just what it is. All right,
just fall on your own digital sword.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really believe there's an international break coming up because it feels like it's just balls to the wall Premier League football at the moment, which is what I like, by the way. But we've only got this weekend coming up. There's a couple of games midweek this week, and then another round of fixtures at the weekend, and then that's it. We've got a 2-week gap. That international break, I have a feeling, Gareth, there's going to be injuries, there's going to be issues with players, someone's season's going to get ruined through no fault of the club's own. And I'm happy to take bets on what you think it might be, but maybe off air.
to avoid any scope. Do you think there'll be at least one tabloid, explosive tabloid interview of the disgruntled player?
Yeah, there'll be a scandal. Players not in international squads just get bored. They just get bored. And
now's the time to complain about the team and how I'm not being used properly and blah, blah, blah. It's
a source close to the club.
It is a shame
said.
Because it feels a source close to, yeah. But I think that it felt like it took a little while for the Premier League to warm up again after the World Cup, but now we're really in the, you know, full swing. There's, you know, your three classic races for the title, for the top four, and then to avoid relegation are really looking fun this year.
It's really fun. It's a really good league. All right. Well, look, thank you, Gareth Dobson. Have you got anything to plug before we let you go?
Not too much at the moment. I've got, I think it's all the same, you know, exciting musicians out on tour. Go and get a Gold Panda ticket. Go and pick up a new Griff Rhys soundtrack and enjoy.
Lovely stuff. All right, this has been The Whistleblowers. We'll be back same time, same place next Monday with more. Thanks to Gareth. Thanks to Boyd Hilton and to Tom Rennie for contributing as well. All right, have a good one. See you later. Sports Social Podcast Network.